I should think it rather obvious. When I looked over my shoulder at Rory, none of my shock was painted upon his face. What kind of cruel trick is this?
It's not a trick, Diviner.
The old man watched.
I see, he rasped. You mean to rip the veil from her eyes, so to speak.
I had the brimming compulsion to scream, Who are you? On and on, the man's finger stirred clockwise circles in the black ink of his inkwell.
Traum's historian. It's knowledge. It's greatest craftsman.
He came toward me with pounding steps, as if he weighed a great deal, and the echoes travelled far and near.
For nothing but ink and the persuasive quill can devise what is true.
A chill set its claws in me. I could see his paws, the lines of his face. Save his eerie stone eyes, he looked so mortal. Those are the words of the harried scribe, an omen, a god. I stared at his inkwell. But you, you're just a man. He blinked once, twice. Then, far quicker than a man his age had any right to be, he flung the ink from his inkwell and vanished. The ink came at me in a black glob. I winced, waiting for it to splash upon my face. It didn't. There was a ripple in the daylight, and then the ink was gone, replaced by the man who'd thrown it. He'd travelled nigh 20 paces on that tide of ink, invisible, until he was but a whit from my face.
Are these the eyes of a mortal, the inkwell of a mere man?
His breath smelled of limestone rubbed too hard or too long. Rotten.
I am Traum's scribe. I've walked the cobbled streets of the Siege for over 2 centuries, bearing magic. My ink never dries. A tool, a weapon. I can travel without being seen, lay waste to ravenous sprites. My writings have inspired reason, invention. My inkwell is a portent of things good or bad, but I have ever been an idol of knowledge, a symbol of truth. What is a god, if not that?
I was shaking. Rory's hand found my elbow, a warm stanchion to keep me sound. Don't touch me. I jerked away, carrying myself away to the nearest tower of shelves, fighting the rabid urge to be sick.
And you?
The man, the harried scribe, turned his stone gaze to the others.
It's been a long while since someone has stumbled upon my dwelling.
King Castor cleared his throat. It was I who discovered you, scribe, last night in the market square. I placed a rather potent gift upon your altar. When you came to retrieve it, my knight and I followed you hence. The scribe's nostrils flared.
And you are?
Yes, I can see why you might not know, given that I am new and not wearing my armour. King Castor laboured to swallow. I am the king. The scribe barked out a laugh.
Truly, your ilk gets younger with time.
He looked fondly upon his inkwell.
Which is why my ilk remain ever at the helm.
King Castor turned as red as a pomegranate. There are benefits to youth, Rory snapped. The metal to break from tradition, for one. That seemed to hearten the king. He drew in a wavering breath.
We have come to challenge you at your craft and claim your inkwell, harried scribe. I, Benedict Castor III, am taking up the mantle.
My gasp was a ghost floating through the room. Claim your inkwell. I looked to the harried scribe, expecting wrath, but he was still, standing in the middle of his great room, fixed in the light of the dome, surrounded by his books. He looked so untouchable, so solemn and imperious, that for a moment I wondered if I'd been wrong. Perhaps he was more than just a man with strange eyes and a magic inkwell. Perhaps he was divine, an omen, a true god. Which would make what Rory and Maud and King Castor were doing sacrilege. Cold, hard, blasphemy. Take up the mantle, you say? Stone of eye, stiff and wan of face, the harried scribe exhibited no emotion, but there was an air of menace about him when his attention fixed upon the king. And when you failed to defeat me at my craft? Maud moved to stand closer to King Castor. Then we will be at your mercy. The scribe bared his teeth. I wished he hadn't. They were grey and cracking, like he'd pressed his jaw down with too brutal a strength. Then I accept. He flung his ink, disappeared. When he was corporeal again, he stood directly in front of me. Hard hands found my waist. More ink was flung, and a terrible weightlessness touched my body. I went invisible and was lifted off my feet, flung upward. I landed in the harried scribe's clutches upon one of his shelves, 50 feet above the floor. Below, the others were shouting, "Fear not, my dear." The scribe brushed my hair out of my face as I grasped for something besides him to cling to. "I shall protect you against these disbelievers." He reached for a book, began to thrum through its pages. "This has happened before, of course. Heretics have found me. Tried to take what is mine, tried to steal my inkwell, my power. They never do, and it always ends the same way." He grinned at me, revealing those awful teeth. In blood. Oh, gods, it was a mistake looking down. My stomach was in my throat. What is taking up the mantle?
Thievery. Descent.
He closed the book he was reading and flung it, its responding thud against the stone floor, echoing through the room.
A king's quest to claim all 5 stone objects and take the power of the omens for himself. But to succeed, he pulled another book, then flung it as well. My craft is knowledge, and they must beat me by it, which of course they will not.
He leaned over, called down to the others.
There will be 3 questions. You must answer at least 1 correctly. Then you must ask me a question that I cannot answer.
Rory's expert profanity drowned him out.
Bring her down, you fucking cur, or I will...
Maud gripped him by the arm and said something I could not hear, silencing him. The shelf creaked beneath my shifting weight. Sweat pooled in my palms. I want to get down, I told the scribe.
Shh.
He sniffed the air, then drew closer.
I won't let you fall.
He put a cold finger under my chin and lifted it, baring my throat to him. He sniffed that, too.
Strange that Ashling has sent you to me in this fashion. I've never felt a diviner's pulse before. Even stranger that you come under the wing of a heretic.
Once, back at the cathedral, a merchant had tried to pull one's shroud off. He'd scratched her cheek. A moment later, he was on his face, motionless, bleeding into the gravel. A gargoyle had hit him so hard in the head, his skull had cracked. At the time, I'd been reassured that such volatile, terrifying beasts were looking out for the diviners. It was only after that I became unsettled. Volatile, terrifying beasts were, after all, difficult to read, impossible to predict. I knew the machinations of the harried scribe's inkwell, knew how to read his portents. And yet, sitting on a shelf with him, so far above the ground, I was at the hands of something volatile, terrifying, wholly unpredictable. I haven't been sent, I managed. I've come because of my diviners.
We await your question, scribe, Maud called from below.
The scribe forgot me, dropping my chin to look down upon the others.
Since you are a king, and these, I suspect, your appointed knights, I will transpose my questions into that which you can understand. Love, faith, and war. The virtues of knighthood.
Rory rolled his eyes.
Let us begin with a question of love.
The omen flung his ink and vanished, reappearing on a shelf below me and pulling free a leather-bound book.
What, according to the Sieges poet laureate, Ingel Taliesin, does a king gift his bride upon their wedding night?
I could tell by the tight lines of Maud's, Rory's, and the king's mouths that none of them knew the answer. After a moment's deliberation, King Castor said, "A dower share of his land and wealth." The harried scribe grinned, cleared his throat, and began to read.
How keen the young king to take up his bride, how noble and steadfast is he. With wine, with brine, the vows are all said, his heart hence taken by she. But pray, what gift should he tend his new queen? What token could ever compare? No silk is so soft as the touch of her skin, no portrait, no jewel so fair. Perhaps a song composed in her name, or maybe an altar, a shrine, or even the moon brought down from above. Nay, his cock will do fine.
The scribe let out a raucous laugh. I stared at him, dumbfounded. That's horrendous. Below, Maud was rubbing her brow.
Poet laureate, my ass.
Never trust anything written in rhyme, Rory muttered.
Not well read, I see. The harried scribe composed himself. I find courtly love rather banal, but a laugh from the belly is a welcome occasion.
He snapped the book shut, vanished, then reappeared on the shelf next to me, making it shake.
On to faith, then.
This question required no book. The harried scribe leaned forward, perched like a gargoyle upon his shelf. His rasp dripped with mirth.
What was the name of the first diviner? The foundling child who came to the Tor and named the omens.
The trio beneath me balked.
The abbess does not speak it in her divination story, Maud called. It's never been spoken.
The scribe toyed with the sleeve of my cloak.
Is that your answer? That the first diviner was without a name?
Another biting moment, then King Castor said,
It is.
Pity.
Once more you are incorrect.
King Castor and Maud were unmoving, and Rory the opposite. Slouched, boot tapping, hand fidgeting incessantly in his pocket. Only one question remained.
What was it?
I whispered. The child's name.
All that matters is that I know it, and they did not know it.
The omen rolled his jaw, his shoulders, joints cracking, pointing to his shelves.
Knowledge is mine to bear and theirs to beg, even if they manage to get the next one right.
His lips peeled back in a grotesque smile.
They are condemned.
I looked down at the others and felt as though I was dreaming, prickling, sweating, afraid. Please, you must be aware that diviners have gone missing from the Tor. I have left Aisling in search of them. The scribe threw his ink before I could finish, and vanished, then appeared on a shelf across the room.
My final inquiry,
he called down to the king, and Rory, and Maud,
is a riddle of war.
Another lovely poem, I hope,
Rory deadpanned.
The siege keeps its books, but also its forges, its armories and arsenals. This composition I penned myself.
The scribe held out a leaflet. I was afforded the barest glimpse of its cover. A moth. Once more, the omen cleared his throat and read.
not hefty in weight or long in the arm. It's thin as a reed in the ground. Kept sharp or kept dull, however you're fond, its customs and merits abound. So too is it stocky, a blunt heavy head, with sturdy wood handle to grasp. With bodily might it swings and it splits, with one fist or two to hold clasp. In battle or field or wherever you stray, keep fixed in slack loops on your belt. For breaking and beating, passion or labour, there ne'er was a blow thusly dealt.
The scribe's stone eyes lowered.
Well, king, what weapon does this poet describe?
The king, Rory and Maud, all wore the same heavy brow, as if burdened by their own contemplation. But I was back on the tour, back to my chores, back to the stone wall. I'd spent days feeling ignorant and unworldly and helpless, a victim of my own occupation and the cathedral's tight fist. How fitting that the answer to the harried scribe's riddle should be that which I took from Ashling itself. My posture went rigid, and Rory's gaze shot up. He studied me a long moment, as if unfurling the riddle of me and not the one the harried scribe had posed. His lips pulled back in a smile, and then he was leaning over, whispering in King Castor's ear. The king let out a fraught sound of relief, then straightened himself. "It's not a singular weapon," he said to the scribe. "It's two, a hammer and a chisel." The omen went still, and so did the sound in his cavernous room. He vanished, appearing once more on the shelf next to me. This time, when he dipped his finger into his inkwell, he stirred it counterclockwise.
"What would you ask me, then, King of Traum?" he challenged. "To beat me at my craft."
King Castor stepped closer to Rory and Maud.
"Allow us a moment to confer. Never say I am not a generous god."
The harried scribe watched them, drawing near to me, petting my head like I was a dog.
"Do not worry," he murmured. "They will not ask a question I have not already penned the answer to. Only ink and the persuasive pen."
"If you know all," I said, trying again, "you must tell me what has happened to my lost divinus." The scribe pulled away. I felt a sharp sting, several strands of my pale hair caught in the cracks of his aged hand. He brought them to his nose, inhaled.
"Your divinus?"
His mouth opened, a wide, black hole, and then he was tossing my hair into his mouth, groaning in ugly ecstasy.
"You belong to Ashling, to the omens. That's what I know, and what I know is ever the truth."
Below, Rory and Maud and the king were looking up once more, eyes darting between me and the harried scribe.
"Speaking of diviners," Rory called.
He said it idly, but the line of his shoulders was drawn tight as a bowstring.
"Tell me, scribe, do you favour them? Ashling's holy dreamers, the hard-labouring harbingers of the omens?"
The scribe spat dark phlegm at the king.
"I favour my diviners more than you your gods, heretic."
The phlegm fell, missing King Castor and landing on Rory's boots. He glowered at his feet.
"Will everyone kindly leave my fucking boots alone?"
"Our question is rather simple, omen," King Castor said in a rush. "Since you claim divinity, the god of all knowledge, tell us." He nodded at me.
"What's her name?"
The harried scribe's teeth groaned as he bit down. When he turned to look at me, his eyes bore a lifelessness not even the stones at Ashling's wall, with their lichen and weather-worn floors, possessed.
"She is a daughter of Ashling. She has no name."
"Sybil," came the faintest whisper deep within me. "Everyone has a name," I murmured. even foundlings. Then, with sudden, biting clarity, if you were truly a god, you would know it. They knew then that they'd beaten him. Rory, Maud, and the king were grinning, standing tall, looking more fearsome and valiant than I'd ever seen them. They'd challenged the Harrod scribe to his own craft, his own knowledge, and won. The scribe knew it too. I could see it, even in the emptiness of his stone eyes, the moment he realized that his magic inkwell was forfeit. The omen dipped his gnarled finger into his inkwell, stirring it counterclockwise with a sudden fury. Then, with the same revulsion I'd seen the scribe at the bridge display when he'd attacked the sprite, he turned his inkwell over, upending its ink onto Rory and Maud and the king. This time, the ink was not transportive. It was a weapon. It landed on the arm of Maud's cloak. She let out a sharp noise and shoved King Castor and Rory back. The ink on her sleeve turned a molten red, burning like coal through the wool. Maud flung her cloak off, but the unmistakable smell of burnt fabric and burnt flesh lingered in the air. The harried scribe laughed, and then he vanished, appearing on a shelf across the room, throwing ink once more. "What are you doing?" I cried. The omen did not answer but to bark at me. "Stay as you are, diviner." It was terrifying, watching him vanish and reappear, invariable in his movements and the flinging of his ink. Smells of burnt paper or wool and even hair filled the room. Rory and Maud and the king were fast on their feet, eyes up and weapons drawn, but Maud's axe and the king's sword were nothing to the ink. They were struck, burned, several times, but they did not flee. Maud's voice ripped through the room. "You are defeated at your craft. Where is your honor? You're hurting them," I screamed, watching as spots of ink burned King Castor's hand. The boy king winced, dodging the rest of the ink, swiping at the harried scribe with his sword and hitting nothing but air. The same terror I felt dreaming, the keen sense of entrapment, was upon me. I wanted to fall into darkness and find myself somewhere else, to wake the fuck up, only this wasn't a dream. If I shattered my body falling, there was no waking up whole. One wrong move and I would plummet, thudding upon the floor like one of the scribe's books. I began to climb down from the shelves, closer, closer to the ground I got, until I was but 10 hands from the floor. A cold hand caught my arm. I looked into stone eyes. The harried scribe bared his teeth. "I told you to stay." It wasn't a conscious effort, what I did next. More like instinct, like muscle memory, the will to live. Strong and exact, my palm collided with the omen's inkwell, knocking it from his grasp. He let out a wretched sound, swiping at air, but the inkwell was already falling. It fell and fell until it clattered upon the stone floor, ink spilling like a great black wound. The harried scribe's hand, now empty, began to shake. He turned it on me, striking my face, his blow so vicious, my lip split. I lost my grip upon the shelf, and then, just like his inkwell, I fell. My back slapped against stone as I hit the floor, wind shooting from my lungs. I coughed, blood spraying from my split lip onto the floor. A grotesque noise, a cry and a moan, sounded above me. The harried scribe let go of the shelf, falling, then landing with a horrible crunch next to me. I flinched, expecting another blow. He fell to his knees instead. The scribe lay out upon the ground, prostrating like an overturned book, like a supplicant. He stuck out a mottled tongue and began to lick my blood from the floor. I tried to get away, but the omen's horrible eyes wheeled onto my bloody lip. Springing to his knees, he crawled like a beast toward me. He looked possessed, as if he'd forgotten his surroundings, his vast stores of knowledge, reduced to a primal urge to chase me. His cold hand closed around my ankle, pulled me toward him. "I can smell it," the harried scribe hissed. "It's in your blood, Ashling's waters." Rory caught the scribe's collar in an iron fist. He yanked the omen away from me, then threw him upon the floor in the heart of the vast room. Rory stood with King Castor and Maud, who leered over the omen, their faces painted with disgust. "What do you think?" the king said, his cheeks speckled with burns. "His hands?" Maud offered. The fabric of her sleeve was in tatters, the skin beneath angry and red. "Or his throat?" Rory was without burn. He reached into his pocket, extracted his coin.
"Why not both?"
The room was split by a thunderous crack. My knees buckled, red dust filling the air. The harried scribe was no longer in one piece, but hundreds, like the mirror I'd shattered in my bedroom. Only the pieces of him were not glistening. They were thick and weeping, as if the scribe had been composed of but two things, bloody flesh and stone. I swallowed sickness and fled. I made it to the dark corridor, running over woolen rugs when Rory caught me. His fingers clasped my shoulder, but I answered in kind, turning around to take his arm and slam him into the wall. He didn't fight me. I could tell by the tilt of his head against the wood panel that he'd expected my ire. What he hadn't expected was my hand diving into his pocket. The front one along the left side of his waist, the one his fingers fidgeted in. That's where he kept it. Rory's eyes widened. He wrenched me away by the wrist.
"I'll likely regret saying this, but keep your hands out of my pants."
That coin. I was shaking, seething. "Where did you get it?" He didn't answer. He just kept glaring down at my shroud like he wanted to rip it off. "The inkwell is to the harried scribe, and that coin is to the artful brigand. You're him, aren't you?" I recoiled until my back hit the opposite wall. "You're an omen." He held his silence like a ransom. Then,
"The coin belonged to the artful brigand."
He withdrew the coin from his pocket, turning it slowly between his fingers.
"It belonged to him right up until 5 days ago, when we went to Castle Lurik, challenged him to his craft, and used it to kill him. As to the accusation, I'm not one of your precious gods, Diviner."
His eyes flickered in the darkness.
"I'm the one who's killing them."
Chapter 12. Our feet will take us where we need to go. He did not stop me from leaving. Not that he could have. There was an insurgency in my body. If it was not spent out running, I might have easily put it into my fists and broken some vital part of Roderick Mendacious. When I crashed out of the harried scribe's lair into daylight and the narrow alley, the gargoyle was where I'd left him, sleeping next to Fig. He'd pulled the saddle blanket and draped it over his head, muffled snores sounding beneath it. I tore it off. "We must go." He gasped, then grimaced.
"You'd think one versed in dreaming would know it is rude to wake someone from sleep."
"Dire circumstances, gargoyle." I wrenched free my hammer and chisel, voices, King Castor's and Rory's and Maud's, sounding in the corridor behind me. "Take my hand." He did so without question, his stone footsteps a raucous toll as he followed me at a run out of the alleyway. We muddled through gawking crowds, down serpentine streets, over bridges, past factories and city gardens, lost like fallen milk teeth within the Siege's yawning mouth. When I was too breathless to go on, we stopped on an empty bridge over a narrow canal.
"I forget, Bartholomew," said the gargoyle. "Why are we running?"
I draped myself over the stone rail like a dirty, wet dress and hauled in breaths. Don't trust king, knights, omen. Need to think.
Just as well. Discussing things with that equine proved quite a bore.
The gargoyle sighed, suddenly forlorn.
I confess, horses are not the intelligent beasts I imagined them to be, though I don't think that merits the abuse they suffer post-mortem.
That one took me a moment. No one actually beats dead horses, Gargoyle. It's an expression.
Really?
How morbid. He began to hum to himself, and I could hardly catch my breath. The pieces of my life had been stained by the scribe's ink, by his face and words and death. What do you know about the omens, Gargoyle? I managed. I never thought to ask you.
Because you believe yourself better than me?
That's not... I looked over my shoulder at him. Maybe. Maybe I thought there was a hierarchy to Aeshling, like I thought there was to all of Traum. The gargoyles were better than other sprites, just like knights and kings were better than craftsmen, and that I was better than all of them. I bit my lip. It sounds awful when I say it out loud.
True things often do.
I don't believe I am better than you. I dropped my forehead onto the bridge's stone rail. I don't know what to believe. The gargoyle held still, but for his snout, which wrinkled in concentration.
Does not the abbess say that the omens are gods, and you are special to divine for them?
It is possible the abbess does not know all there is to know about the omens. Sickness stirred in my belly. Or that she, too, does not like saying true things out loud.
I suppose that is a permanent possibility. Even your dreams may not show you the truth, Bartholomew. I cannot remember it ever being proven that gods are more honest than anyone else.
The omens' creeds are about truth. I always assumed them virtuous, eternal, immortal. I looked out over the canal. But it seems they are none of those things. Boats passed beneath our bridge, long and narrow, and laden with goods. Craftsmen carrying their stock. A dory filled with bread passed by, and my stomach rumbled.
When was the last time you bolstered yourself with food and water?
The gargoyle asked. I don't know. A while.
Slept?
Longer still.
Whatever thinking you must do, you cannot do it like this.
He blew air from pouted lips.
What woe is mine, ever to child mind you.
We had no money for an inn, but we did happen upon an empty forge with a caved-in roof. It smelled of dirt and coal and fires long burned out. I lay my head upon my arm, closed my eyes, and was lost to sleep in seconds. I woke from a dreamless oblivion with a racing heart and did not know where I was. The walls, the smells, this wasn't my cottage. But the crescent moon floated through a broken roof, and I was able to make out that I was in a forge upon a lowly bed of dirt. I'm in the siege. My memory came slowly, then far too fast. I'm with the gargoyle in the siege. The diviners are gone, and the omens are a lie. It was quiet, so horribly quiet without the diviners, breathing next to me in their sleep. I sat up. The gargoyle stood a pace away, humming to himself as he looked out a window with broken shutters. Next to him were a tin pitcher and a plate of bread and cheese and apples. My stomach yanked. Where did you get that? He screamed.
Sprites and spoons! You startled me, Bartholomew!
Have you been stealing, Gargoyle?
Yes, he said with delight. I'm rather good at it. I was caught only twice. But you look stern. Have I behaved ignobly again by your childish standards?
He had,
But it wouldn't be a stretch to assume he'd throw the pilfered food out the window if I told him as much. Not at all. Besides, I'm starved. The pitcher was full of water. I drained it and devoured the food platter. Thank you. The gargoyle watched me eat, then picked up my hammer and chisel.
Are we leaving, Bartholomew?
I took the tools in my hands. Even with their familiar weight, I felt unbalanced. I think... perhaps we...
You seem troubled.
The gargoyle looked up at me with wide, earnest eyes.
Would you like me to tell you a story?
No one could craft a story fine enough to make me feel better right now, gargoyle. He nodded, like I'd said something profound.
Then let us explore this strange mechanism named the Seech instead. Our feet will take us where we need to go.
The night sky announced every turn the gargoyle and I took, throwing moon shadow, our silhouettes twisted figures upon the street. I didn't mind. The moon's vigilant quality was not disapproving like Ashling's. I didn't feel the urge to watch my back. I kept my hood low, and the gargoyle, not one to be left out, stole a tablecloth from a clothesline to drape over his head, obscuring his face in shadow. Still, it was too early, or too late, for there to be any foot traffic. Hardly anyone looked at us. That did not mean the roads were empty. People milled about, awake despite the hour, different from the folk I'd seen in the Siege in the light of day. Children in rags, men and women digging through scraps and washing their clothes in the canal. I was stricken by shame when I caught myself staring. I'd never seen poverty before. We carried on, entirely without aim, though at some point I slid both hammer and chisel into my left hand so that the gargoyle could hold my right. My mind remained on the harried scribe, his stone eyes, the way he had eaten my hair, licked up my blood. I thought of King Castor too, what it might mean, him taking up the mantle, challenging the omens for their magical stone objects. I thought on the diviners, and how I was no closer to finding them. I considered it all, a canyon worrying itself between my brows. Meanwhile, the gargoyle was practically skipping down the street, pointing and commenting on everything he saw. You seem contented, I said, peering over my shoulder. Being away from Ashling.
Perhaps I am.
He pondered.
What does it feel like to be contented, Bartholomew?
As if I knew. The only happiness I'd felt was with the diviners, in the tales of what we might do when we left the Tor. My stock of joy was held in the future, ever out of reach. I think contentedness, I said bitterly, is just a story we tell ourselves. The gargoyle nodded.
It's all the same then. Contentedness, truth and honesty and virtue. Omens. They are all stories, and we,
he gestured to the Siege's climbing walls,
tread the pages within them.
Our feet did indeed take us where we needed to go. When the sky was purple, clouds blushing from a dawn we could not yet see, the gargoyle and I came across a street with plain brick houses. The largest had an inscription upon its door. Pupil House 3, a school for foundlings.
How quaint, the gargoyle said. I confess, I've always fancied myself a bit of a schoolmaster, and you my pupil, Bartholomew, though you have never held the position with the respect it's due. I say, what are you doing?
Wait here. I rushed to the house, opening its gate and tripping over little shoes. They'll get a fright if a menacing stone bat knocks upon their door.
That's derogatory, he called after me.
I knocked 3 times, waited, knocked again, louder. I heard creaking, the shuffling of footsteps. Then the door was opening, wrenched in by an aged woman in a nightdress with a lump of grey hair and deeply etched lines around her eyes and lips. She thrust a candle in my face,
Who the hell are you?
Apologies for the intrusion, milady. I know it's early.
Milady? What kind of twaddle is that? I'm the house mother. If you're looking to drop off a foundling, we're all full.
I'm not here for that. I pulled my hood down. I'd like to ask you a question. Her brows lifted into her hairline. What's a girl from Ashling doing at my door?
Come to check on your investment?
What investment? Your abbess is our patron. I'd almost forgotten. Do the girls the abbess selects ever come back?
Here? I can't see why they would.
So you haven't seen any diviners of late?
None save you, mourning dove.
My chest fell. The woman crossed her arms, eyeing my split lip. You look like you've had a time of it. She sighed and pushed open her door. Want a cup of something? No, thank you. I looked up at the dawning sky. How many pupil houses are there?
3. The other hamlets send their orphans here, but mainly the girls, especially the poor sick ones. Gives them a good shot to end up at Ashling as diviners. Most of the boys run off and fend for themselves.
Can you tell me where I might find the next pupil house?
Off the square, but you won't find any diviners there either.
Off the square. Wonderful. Where's that? Pupil house 2 had darkened windows. This house mother answered the door with a broom and nearly fell over when she saw my shroud. She hadn't seen any diviners either. A baker, opening his shop, who dropped his flour at the sight of the gargoyle, pointed us to the final pupil house. There, the house mother slept through my knocking, and her dog ventured out in her stead. The mutt chased us for 3 city blocks. All the while the gargoyle shouted, his voice ringing through the streets,
"Fear not, Bartholomew! Every day has its dog!"
The siege was waking up, its impoverished citizens slipping into shadow. When dawn came, the gargoyle and I did the same, retreating into an empty alley and slumping to the ground, defeated. I pretended one was there, sitting next to me. I was so important at Ashling. Climbing the wall, looking out at the view, I thought it would be the same when my service was up, that for all the dreams I've endured, I'd be important in the hamlets too, that Traum, its people, its omens, would love me. I traced the split in my lip the harried scribe had dealt. But 4 was right. We will only ever be diviners, harbingers of gods, not real women. People will want us without ever wishing to know us. A daughter of Ashling is not a real daughter, just as the abbess... I swallowed. Just as the abbess is not a real mother. Diviners are but the tools of the craft of divination. Holy, not human.
The cathedral, its omens, its diviners sit on high, the gargoyle said plainly. If you only ever look up at something, can you ever see it clearly?
I suppose not. I pressed the heels of my palms into my eyes. But really, I tried to be good, to be a perfect diviner, and do everything the abbess told me to. I never complained, never said no. My worth was written by the rules I followed. But then the abbess called me resentful, a martyr. And maybe I am. But didn't I become that way because her love cost as much? The gargoyle took my hand.
That is a very sad story, Bartholomew. I wonder, how does it end?
I don't know. I don't know what to do, or who to believe in, or how to find my friends. A sharp pressure began behind my eyes. I don't know who I am without Ashling. We sat in a silence he no doubt found contemplative, and I oppressive. An hour later, the streets now properly busy, a pair of girls came down the alley toward us. They wore simple garb and looked no older than 12. I thought of the diviners. How does the abbess choose the foundlings she brings to Ashling? I asked the gargoyle as they passed. He put a thoughtful claw to his stone lip.
All I know is that they are always girls, and often sick.
Why?
She told me once. I don't remember when nor why.
The melodramatics he was so apt to show were nowhere upon his face. This time, the gargoyle seemed truly overcome by sadness.
She said that girls bear the pain of drowning better, and that sick ones always wake strange, special, and new.
My throat tightened. Meanwhile, the girls, passing in the alley, paid us no mind. Their pace hurried. I barely had time to pull my feet back, lest they trip.
"Good morning,"
the gargoyle said cheerily, his melancholy gone. The girls didn't answer. Their gazes were cast over their shoulders, their eyes wide and stricken. There, behind them, three men, stalking forward. They made like they were casual, hands in their pockets, but I could see exactly what they were by their committed steps, the hungry, fixed line of their gazes. Wolves, stalking, mewling fawns. They came past where the gargoyle and I were seated. With my cloak and his tablecloth, we no doubt looked like a pair of vagabonds. The men did not ever look our way, watching only the fleeing girls. My foot shot out. The first man went down hard, landing on his forearms near the gargoyle's feet, blocking the alleyway with his body. The man behind him swore, kicked my leg out of his way. Clumsy bitch. I rose to my feet. Why are you chasing little girls down the street? Get out of my face. He stamped his palm over my cheek and shoved me into the alley wall. My other cheek scraped against brick, cutting my skin, stirring my shroud. And I did not think. I just swung. And all hell broke loose. My hammer made no noise, save the sick crack of bone. The answer was a blood-curdling scream, and the alley became a knot of limbs, shouts, and blood. The gargoyle rose to his feet, trampling the first man I'd hit, trying to get to me. Meanwhile, the third man, shoving past his friend, whose elbow I'd decidedly shattered, levied his fist. He landed a weak punch to my stomach. No follow-through, because the gargoyle had him by the back of the neck, claws digging into flesh as he wrenched him back. My hood dropped, and the gargoyle's tablecloth fell. When the man saw who exactly he was kicking and thrashing at, he went still.
"Diviner, please, we didn't want anything with the young girls. Just a friendly..."
"I'm friendly too," the gargoyle said. "So is Bartholomew."
He looked at my hammer, held once more at the ready, and winked.
"Aren't you?"
He pushed the man toward me. I dropped him with a horrible thwack of my hammer, right in his ribs.
"Guards!"
One of the men was screaming. The first one, the one I'd tripped, who'd been clever enough to stay down. He was screaming out the mouth of the alley. There, two armed guards wearing grey sashes had stalled, looking at us with narrowed eyes. The man kept screaming.
"Guards! Help!"
Hands fell to the hilts of swords. I spat blood onto cobblestones. "Take my hand, gargoyle." And then we were running. Again. We crawled over the men, a mess of groaning limbs.
"Didn't that feel so delightfully ignoble?" the gargoyle howled, grinning madly as we scurried like rats down the alley.
We passed brick and wood and stone, taking so many turns I fell upside down. I thought we'd gotten away, but one wrong turn begot another, and then the gargoyle and I were faced with a looming wood edifice. A dead end.
"Quick, fly us out of here!"
He looked at me like I'd spat in his eye.
"And be mistaken yet again for a bird?"
The guards were upon us. When they caught us against a wall, they slowed to a halt, kept their hands fast upon their hilts. "Those men were going to hurt a pair of girls," I said, the urge to confess akin to throwing up spring water. "We were defending them."
"Did a bit more than that," one of the two guards said. "They'll need a physician. You're both from Ashling."
I puffed up my chest. "I'm a diviner."
"Number 6?"
"Who's asking?" The guards looked at each other.
There's a warrant out for your arrest.
The gargoyle snorted.
For what? Stealing breakfast and a tablecloth and...
I put my hand over his mouth. Surely you have better things to do than hound us for a bit of petty crime.
Excuse me, I am a thief as well as an assailant,
the gargoyle said, breaking free of my clutches and sticking up his nose.
Nothing petty about that.
Unfortunately, this warrant comes from on high. The guards turned, heads close together, quietly conferring.
I wonder what they are talking about,
the gargoyle mused. I touched my bottom lip, bleeding again from when that pig had shoved me against the wall. I was muttering indignities to myself when the taller of the two guards split off, going back down the alley. The other turned to the gargoyle and me. By her tight shoulders, she didn't seem pleased. Were she a diviner, I'd have guessed she'd just pulled the short straw. She didn't take her hand off her sword. Follow me. We were delivered to a walled compound, where a strange cracking noise echoed behind a vast wooden door. Bug-eyed, its sentry watched the gargoyle and me approach, and with one word from our escort guard, he opened the door. We came upon a gravel yard, sectioned by two crossing ropes, a pair of knights standing in each quadrant. They each bore a whip, the source of the cracking noise I'd heard, and were practicing wielding the long, serpentine weapons. Those not occupied in the training watched from the sidelines, drilling or goading their fellow knights, until they weren't watching anything but me. I recognized a few. Hamelin, the one I'd almost taken to the grass, was cracking his whip in the nearest quadrants. When he saw me, he coughed, choking on his own surprise. Then, as if by silent order, they all looked away, their focus back on their work, and decidedly away from me and my stone companion. As to the likely reason why, he stood in shadow on the sideline. Leather-clad, new charcoal drawn around his eyes, he was looking at me through an uncharacteristic crack in his derision, as if something he did not fully believe in had suddenly appeared right in front of him. Roderick Mendacious. The guard brought the gargoyle and me before him.
These are the ones you've been looking for.
I glared from behind my shroud. On high is a bit overstated, isn't it? A smile ghosted across Rory's lips.
Where were they?
He asked the guard. Brawling on the east side. Rory's smile vanished, his dark eyes skittering to a halt over on my face, my freshly bleeding bottom lip. He stared a moment, then another. Ever so slowly, his gaze rose to the guard at my side.
Which lowly picket of the siege struck her?
She put her hands in the air. She was like that when we found her. Her and the gargoyle roughed up some vile men, I interrupted. Whoever they were, the guard said. Geordie went to fetch them a physician. Rory didn't answer. His gaze was still on my bottom lip.
Anywhere else?
I suddenly didn't know. His eyes were so dark. I'm fine.
I too am unharmed.
The gargoyle patted his stone chest.
Right as raindrops.
So close. Rory's gaze didn't leave my face. He reached into his pocket, extracted 3 gold coins, then handed them to the guard.
Much obliged.
She took the money, giving me a wide berth, then quit the compound.
Well,
the gargoyle said, yawning as he watched her go,
I'm due for a good sleep. Where can I station myself so as not to hear the revelry of these...
He waved his hand at the knights and their whips.
Riotous clods.
Rory looked halfway to laughing, halfway to questioning his own sanity.
I can't tell if it will make you cry to tell you to sleep in the stables. Why would that make me cry?
I truly don't know.
Not very shrewd, this one,
the gargoyle muttered. He crossed his arms.
Aren't you going to offer me a blanket?
You get cold.
I like to rest with something over my eyes.
Like covering a birdcage, I explained, adding hurriedly, not that you are anything like a bird.
There should be blankets in the stables. Very well.
The gargoyle sauntered away, but not before casting me a backward glance.
In all your stories of things you might do when you left Ashling, Bartholomew, did you ever tell one like today's?
I managed a weak laugh. Not by a mile. He smiled. When he was gone, into the stable, I felt Rory's gaze on the side of my face. I blew out a sigh, faced him. I have questions. Or must I beat you at your craft to have them answered?
No.
A nearby knight wrapped himself in his own whip, the yard an uproar of laughter. Rory kept his focus on me. But, out of curiosity, what craft is mine, Diviner? Pride? Godlessness? Disdain, maybe?
And you'd defeat me by, what, throwing me down in front of the knighthood? Aiming your pitchfork tongue at me? Calling me stupid and a thousand other unflattering things? I'd say my pride is wholly forfeit at this point.
You say horrible things to me all the time.
I know.
He dragged a hand through his hair.
Perhaps it's why I worried you might be 20 miles away. That I might not...
He made a face.
That you might not come back.
I didn't come back. I was arrested.
You and a gargoyle against a couple of guards, please. You could be halfway to any of the hamlets by now, but you are not.
He paused.
As to the grievance of my godlessness...
Rory's back tensed, shoulders practically at his ears.
You, me, Maud, Benji, the harried scribe. I realise it wasn't exactly a mild way to show you the complexity of the omens.
A complexity I did not yet understand by half.
Nothing about you is mild, mendacious. Your disdain for Ashling, for the omens, for me, has been written on your face from the moment I clapped eyes on you. I sighed. The day was just beginning, and I already felt defeated by it. My own fault for not seeing the signs.
I have disdain in me, yes.
Rory's brows drew together, lips parted slightly enough for me to hear the shaky sound of his exhale.
But none for you.
Our gazes held. They held and held, the effect sharper than the cracking of whips.
Six!
I turned, looking into a pair of beautiful green eyes.
Maud!
She came before me, gripped my arm.
Happy you made it back to us. I meant to ask yesterday.
She looked down at my dirty feet. Where are your shoes?
Rory snorted. We're working on it.
Maud took my hand, winked at Rory, then went into the compound. I should have something that'll fit you.
Oh, there's no need.
I'm being nice. You'll be wanting the king's ear. She threw her arm over my shoulder. But first, you need a bath.
Chapter 13. Take Up the Mantle.
An hour later, when the bath water had gone cold, Maud brought me fresh clothes. Undergarments, two tunics, leggings, wool socks, jerkin, a belt for my hammer and chisel, leather boots. Strange creatures, shoes. I held one up to the bottom of my foot. It was almost the exact right length. Someone had sized me up well. I tossed it into the corner of the washroom, donned the undergarments and ignored the rest of the clothes, opting for my diviner dress. It felt profane, putting filthy clothes over freshly cleaned skin, but I was not yet ready to shed its encasement. I did, however, wear the belt and my hammer and chisel upon it. Maud tutted at my appearance, but made no comment. She escorted me up staircases lined with books until we were on the top floor of the dormitory, standing before a tall chamber door. A knight was there, trembling at the threshold. Next to him stood the gargoyle. His stone nose was fixed upward.
"What is the meaning of this, Bartholomew? I was roused from a perfectly fine nap."
Maud sighed. "I figured you'd want your stone pet with you for the..."
"Don't call him that," I warned. "He'll scream."
"What are you whispering about? Why is your hair all wet and stringy?"
His voice hitched higher.
"Why was I brought in such a callous fashion?"
Maud nodded to the trembling knight. You can go, Dedric. He fled, and Maud stretched her lips with a thin smile and spoke slowly to the gargoyle, like he was a child. You and Six have been invited to speak to the king. We entered the room, which was a richly furnished bedchamber. Like the Harrod scribe's lair, it had a dome ceiling fashioned of glass. There were more shelves, more books, fine rugs, and a bed wide enough to fit five kings. The gargoyle, like it was his own room, made his way to the bed, yawning. Ah! Maud pointed at the large wood table in the centre of the room. Three chairs were placed around it, and three cups, plus one flagon, upon it. He's expecting you there. The gargoyle made a face, pulled a quilted blanket off the bed, wrapped himself in it, and plunked into one of the chairs. I shot Maud an apologetic grin. Her eyes darted between us, like she could not decide which of us was the greater oddity. He'll be here in a moment. Behave. She shut the door. I hurried to the table, pulled my chair close to the gargoyle's, and hissed in his ear. I need you to comport yourself.
I have no idea what that means.
He sniffed the quilted blanket around his shoulders.
Sounds like something one does in a chamber pot.
That, right there, that is not a normal thing to say. Absurdity will throw the conversation off course, and I need clarity from this boy king. For the next quarter hour, every time you feel the compulsion to say something peculiar, smother it. He sank into his chair and sulked.
You ask a great deal of me.
A door on the south wall opened, straight from a shelf. King Castor strode into the room in a fine white tunic, a smattering of scabs across his face where the Harrod scribe's ink had burned him. Midday light fell upon his head, and though he was not wearing a crown, his golden hair was resplendent. He carried two things, that ratty leather-bound notebook I'd seen his first night at Ashling Cathedral, and the Harrod scribe's stone inkwell. I stood from my chair. Majesty. Six.
Bow,
I mouthed to the gargoyle. He made a crude sound of flatulence and didn't get up. I pinched the bridge of my nose. Apologies, King Castor. He has woken prematurely from a nap.
Say no more.
The king put the notebook and inkwell upon the table and took his seat in the last remaining chair, and I fell into mine. Silence took hold of the room. Oh, the king said. You're waiting for me to speak. The gargoyle and I exchanged a look. Forgive me, it's just... Benedict Castor's cheeks grew red. This was Maud's idea, talking to you alone. She thinks I need practice, saying things without her or Rory there to fill in my nervous pauses. What do you have to be nervous about? That made him laugh.
Almost everything. But enough about me. You must have 1,000 questions. Before we begin, however, an egregious oversight must be addressed.
He grinned.
You really should call me Benji.
You don't find that disrespectful?
Rory does it. Rory for Roderick, Benji for Benedict.
He shrugged. It's just a nickname.
An atrocious one,
the gargoyle muttered. King Castor, Benji, to his credit, was not provoked.
Likely, but it fits me well.
He reached for the flagon, poured himself, then me, a healthy helping of ale.
Do you drink?
He asked the gargoyle. He doesn't, I cut in, swiping the gargoyle's cup. He pushed out his lips, pulled the blanket to his chin. 5 seconds later, he was snoring. I looked across the table at the king. This all feels very strange.
Traum is a strange place.
Not so strange that 5 women should vanish into thin air.
Fair enough.
Benji gestured at his notebook, then at the Harrod scribe's inkwell.
Which would you like me to start with? The history of the omens or their magical objects?
It was unbearable that I, a diviner of Ashling Cathedral, should need to be lectured on either. Magical objects.
My favourite.
The king brought his cup to his mouth, exhaling pleasure as he swallowed the ale. It was hardly midday, early for a drink, but the ale seemed to ease him. He took the Harrod Scribe's inkwell and dipped his finger into its ink. As you know, the omens each possess a stone object, the mechanics of which are rather simple. This one, like the scribe said, never runs dry of ink. Stir it clockwise. He began to swirl the ink. Then toss it, and that ink will transport you. King Castor flourished his hand like a performer upon a stage, flung black ink, and vanished. He appeared 10 paces away and bowed. If he wanted me to clap, he could die waiting. Like Mendacious's coin. Quite. All the stone objects have 2 properties. Transportive. He returned to the table, finger back in the ink. This time, he stirred it counterclockwise. And destructive. He poured the ink near the edge of the table, and smoke began to rise. The ink went red, scalding its way through the table, leaving a charred hole and the smell of burnt wood in its wake. The gargoyle sniffed, sneezed, but remained asleep. The artful brigand's coin makes more of an impact. I'm partial to explosions. Benji rubbed some of the charred wood away from his ale and took his seat once more. I'm not entirely sure how the other objects work, the ore and chime and loomstone, but I hope to soon enough. He smiled at me. They are the only pieces of magic in all of Traum. It is my desire to wield them all. What an arrogant little prat. The stone objects aren't the only magic in Traum. You've forgotten Ashling's spring. Ah, yes, to be transported into dreams is surely magic. Benji was quiet a moment. That spring is where it all began. He reached for his notebook, which puts us squarely in the realm of history, I suppose. It was an ancient thing, the notebook. When Benji opened it, thumbing through the pages, I was assaulted by the smells of aged leather and parchment. Every page was full. I glimpsed faded ink, lists and logs, and maps and art, portraits and landscapes. There was very little art at Ashling, but I could tell whoever scribbled these was gifted at their craft. Is this yours?
It belonged to my grandfather, Benedict Castor I. He was the king of Traum before King Augur.
Benji drank deeply from his cup. Have you heard of him?
I hadn't.
The abbess says kings come and go.
How right she is.
I could tell it troubled Benji to speak of his grandfather. His mouth had fallen, but he kept his tone light.
My grandfather's hamlet was Corson Fair, but he was an erudite, multifaceted craftsman, a man before his time. He was elected by the noble elders of the hamlets because of his familiarity with the economics of...
He grinned.
But perhaps this is boring to you.
I was mid-yawn. Sorry.
Don't worry, I was getting to the good part.
My grandfather was a beloved king. Until he wasn't. I was 5 years old when he was stoned to death for heresy. I went still.
Oh. You see, Six, there are 2 stories of Traum's great beginning. The one your abbess touts before a divination, and the one that got my grandfather killed. He wrote it here, in his notebook.
Benji ran his thumb over the pages.
I'm likely not as eloquent as he was, but I'll tell it as best as I can.
I watched his wide eyes, wondering if, behind my shroud, that was how I looked at the abbess, so eager to please. I suddenly felt a surge of pity. Benedict Castor was, after all, only a boy of 17, with everything in the world to prove. Take your time. He hauled in a breath.
Approximately 230 years ago, before Ashling was built, 5 craftsmen came to a tour. A thieving merchant, dubbed a brigand, a scribe, an oarsman, a forester, and a weaver. Traum was in discord. That part of my grandfather's